The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler, and for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the National Geographic and also the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we feature part one of a two-part series on space travel. Space, a New Era of Discovery, is the title given to the October 2023 issue of National Geographic, and the entire issue dedicated to space exploration. Our first article, Up, Up, and Away, written by Michael Greshko, and focuses on how NASA's Artemis program brings us one giant leap closer to the moon, Mars, and beyond. So let us begin. I love it when it just turns into a star, Christina Cook exclaimed. The NASA astronaut and three colleagues dressed in blue flight apparel were standing on a knoll at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, peering into the night sky, as the most powerful rocket that had ever launched turned into a pinprick of light. And as we continue the journey, let me interject here. Ms. Cook recently featured at North Carolina State University. That's her alma mater. Quite an attraction there, I might say, as she also discussed with her audience her work as an astronaut. Now we continue. Minutes earlier, at 1:47 a.m. on November 16, 2022, the 32-story flying machine, known rather prosaically as the Space Launch System, SLS, had lifted off. Through my binoculars, the rocket's orange pillar of exhaust was nearly blinding. Every crackle of its 8.8 million pounds of thrust, equivalent to 31 jumbo jets, rattled my lungs. The colossal rocket, hurtling downrange at more than 17,500 miles an hour, hoisted aloft the Orion spacecraft, designed to carry astronauts farther into space than they have ever ventured. To measure how deep space will affect astronauts, the gumdrop-shaped crew module carried a mannequin named Campos and two female phantoms, or artificial torsos. Over the subsequent 25 days, 10 hours and 53 minutes, the test dummies would roar to more than a quarter million miles from Earth before plunging back through the atmosphere at nearly 25,000 miles an hour. The next Orion will have four people on board as its voyages around the moon. Cook, whose name is pronounced Cook, and it's spelled K-O-C-H, that's why they interject that, she hopes to be among them. The launch of this 2022 mission, named Artemis 1, marked a milestone for NASA, which aims to put humans back on the moon for the first time in more than 50 years. If all goes as planned, Artemis 2 could send a crew on a lunar flyby as soon as November 2024. Then comes Artemis 3, a crewed landing as soon as late 2025, followed by more missions to establish a lunar presence. Why go back to the moon? For one, the lunar surface remains a scientific wonderland. Its rock and dust chronicle the sun's changing activity over 4.5 billion years. Its craters could reveal secrets from the ancient bombardments that also hit Earth. The icy schmutz around the lunar north and south poles might offer insights into how water finds its way through the solar system. Artemis plans to land crews near the South Pole to study these suspected frozen water deposits, a step toward possibly harvesting ice for water, oxygen, and rocket fuel. Now, there are political calculations, too, international cooperation, aerospace contracts, skilled jobs. Beyond that, the moon is preparation for a crewed journey to Mars, perhaps in the 2030s, as part of the agency's push to find out whether the red planet ever harbored life. The moon and Mars differ, but both are forbidding realms where humans need technology such as pressurized habitats and advanced spacesuits to survive. And the moon is only a few days away. With the engines we have today, it could take 7 to 9 months to reach Mars. Artemis has faced challenges, years of delays, billions in cost coverages, skepticism that humans are even needed for space exploration. But if Artemis succeeds, it won't just return astronauts to the lunar surface. could also begin an era of vast possibility and humbling responsibility, one where humankind regularly lives and works in worlds beyond our own. This is turning the first page on a brand new chapter of space exploration, said Jacob Bleacher, NASA's chief exploration scientist. One clear night last October, astronaut Zena Cardman clambered through a field of lava rock on a mock-up spacesuit, her eyes locked on the moonlight landscape. Cardman, a geobiologist, and fellow astronaut Drew Feustel, a geophysicist, were on a mission to collect rock samples near Arizona's SP Crater, an 820-foot-tall cinders cone that formed during an ancient volcanic eruption. Long shadows slithered across the craggy landscape. At a distance, a scientist in a baseball cap wheeled a spotlight around a small cart, keeping it trained on the two astronauts. When Cardman and Feustel dipped out of the glare, meant to replicate the harsh sunlight at the lunar South Pole, they couldn't see more than 30 feet. The duo tried orienting themselves with low-resolution maps meant to simulate working off satellite images. No GPS or compass bearings were allowed. Neither would be much use on the moon missions. It was actually remarkably difficult to pinpoint where we were, Cardman said. Mission control is telling us we're pretty sure you should see a hill in front of you, and we're like, maybe? The main goal of this simulated moonwalk and other analog missions isn't to train astronauts. Instead, they're meant to test everything else, from the chisels that moonwalkers will wield to the procedures that mission control will follow back on Earth. And then, after years of careful rehearsal, it will be time for liftoff. It's starting to sink in that it's real, said Jessica Meir, a member of the astronaut corps since 2013. Nothing of this scale has ever launched during my lifetime. Mayer has prepared for this moment since she was 5 years old. When her first grade teacher asked her class to draw what they wanted to be when they grew up, she didn't just draw an astronaut, she drew one on the moon. A biologist by training, Mayer once focused her research on how penguins and geese respond physiologically to extreme environments. Now she works in one. From September 2019 to April 2020, she lived aboard the International Space Station, or ISS, and performed nearly 22 hours of spacewalks outside the station with crewmate Cook, the first spacewalks ever conducted by an all-woman team. In its early days, NASA had a narrow view of the right stuff for astronauts, all male, mostly military test pilots. Today, they might be submariners or submariners or seismologists, programmers or physicians, women and men from an eclectic background or an array of backgrounds. One of the Artemis program's stated goals is to put the first woman and person of color on the moon. We're bringing the spirit of the entire planet with us, Mayer told me. Bill Nelson recalls exactly where he was when Apollo 11 commander Neil Armstrong took his first steps on the moon, in a hotel room in London just before 4 a.m., enraptured by the grainy broadcast on a black-and-white TV. Nelson grew up in Melbourne, Florida. As scientists and rocketeers were turning nearby Cape Canaveral, Apollo's eventual home port, into a missile test site. Later, in his career as a congressman and senator from Florida, he established himself as a legislative leader on space policy. In 1986, he even flew on a 6-day space shuttle mission. Now 80 and NASA administrator, he is overseeing Artemis' first missions. Artemis, as we know it today, grew out of a Trump-era push to put humans on the moon as a stepping stone to Mars. The Biden administration has embraced it with minor tweaks, but arguably the Artemis era began on February 1, 2003, when the space shuttle Columbia broke apart during reentry and killed its 7 crew members. The disaster, precipitated by mid-launch damage to the shuttle's fragile heat shield, hastened the fleet's retirement and raised the question of what would follow. In 2004, the George W. Bush administration unveiled a moon-to-Mars strategy to replace the shuttle, enshrined into law as the Constellation Program. The initiative, which included Orion, soon blew its budget and fell behind schedule, and in 2010, the Obama administration proposed canceling it. But lawmakers, co-led by Nelson, voted to keep Orion going and back two new rocket strategies, the Commercial Crew Program, which contracts with SpaceX and Boeing to ferry astronauts to the ISS, and the SLS, whose design borrowed as much technology as possible from the 1970s-era space shuttle. All of this represents a substantial national commitment. The NASA Office of Inspector General estimates Artemis's total cost through September 2025 will hit $93 billion. Still, in total spending, an Apollo exceeded $280 billion in today's dollars, and after adjusting for inflation, Apollo's peak annual cost was roughly 60% more than NASA's entire budget today. For all the superficial similarities to Apollo, the big rocket, the gumdrop capsule, Artemis, has modern ambitions. The missions it will fly will be longer. Orion was designed to keep a crew of four alive for up to 21 days, and the electronics on board SLS and Orion are more sophisticated. But NASA's newest vehicles still rely on Apollo's manufacturing network. Both are born in New Orleans, 15 miles east of downtown at NASA's Michaud Assembly Facility. For decades, the 43-acre plant has played a key role in the agency's rocket manufacturing. Once a French sugar plantation, the facility was taken over in 1961 by NASA, eager for a site with a deep-water port to build Apollo's Saturn V rocket. The first stage was made here, so was the space shuttle's fuel tank. Until recently, you didn't get out of Earth orbit unless you went through Michaud, said Amanda Gurgitchison, an engineer with Boeing, an SLS prime contractor. The construction of SLS core stages moves across Michaud from east to west. Curved aluminum panels, which arrive in gigantic wooden crates, are welded into cylindrical segments that get stacked and then welded together. After welds are checked, insulation is added, and avionics systems are installed. Finished core stages are floated by barge to Florida. Orion also makes its way to the Sunshine State, following construction of its main metallic skeleton, led by Lockheed Martin. It's shipped to Kennedy Space Center for assembly. Before that barge ride, the core stage sits in a cavernous room on its side for final assembly. Safety glasses on, Gurgitchison led me around the rocket. At 27.6 feet in diameter and 212 feet long when fully assembled, it felt preposterously big, a pharaonic monument awaiting final lift into space. Silvery piping ran along the outside to feed the fuel to the engines. And when we poked our heads into the engine section, the part of the rocket she manages, the plumbing-stuffed cavity, had the feel of a cramped jungle gym. As sophisticated as this behemoth is, Artisans contribute its finishing touches. Some of the foam insulation is hand-sprayed. Cheese chessboard-like markers along the rocket sides, used to track its orientation and speed from afar, are hand-painted. When you think of building a rocket, you think of rocket scientists, Gurgitchison said. These are only a very small part. At NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, a wall of TV monitors features live video feeds from every conceivable angle of Launch Complex 39B, the Artemis launch pad. During test and launch attempts, this room holds a team of experienced SLS engineers, ready to troubleshoot a problem. You put plans in place to deal with the things that you don't plan on, so when they happen, you're not reacting, you're responding, said David Beeman, who manages this team and hundreds of other engineers. Beeman's father was one of the engineers for the Saturn V rocket, and eventually Beeman found himself in his father's line of work. He started with the shuttle program and took over its booster team. Then Beeman helped establish the structure of NASA's SLS team, painfully aware of the failures that the shuttle had endured, not just the technical ones, but the organizational ones, too. He considers NASA's current safety approach to be less susceptible to human error, a strategy based on taking the extra time to make sure every nagging concern is resolved. If it means making a few hard decisions and waiting a few more days and getting a little more data, we're going to do that, he told me. NASA scrubbed Artemis 1's first launch attempt in August 2022, attended by VIPs including Vice President Kamala Harris, amid concerns over weather, a misbehaving temperature sensor, and a hydrogen fuel leak. The following month, another attempt was called off because of more leaking. Next time, Hurricane Ian, and then in November, Hurricane Nicole, which buffeted the rocket on the launch pad with 100-mile-an-hour gusts. Then another leak appeared, hours before its scheduled November 16th launch. With the rocket almost fully fueled and dangerous to approach, NASA sent a red crew out to hand-tighten nuts on a valve. The rocket, it's alive, it's creaking, it's making venting noises, it's pretty scary, said Trenton Annis, who helped make the repair. Finally, after meeting the 489 criteria necessary for launch, Artemis 1 was on its way. On November 28th, Orion flew beyond the moon to more than 268,500 miles away, nearly 20,000 miles farther than any other human-rated round-trip mission. And then on December 11th, plunked into the ocean off Mexico's Baja California Peninsula. This is what mission access looks like, a relieved Mike Serafin, Artemis 1's mission manager, said after splashdown. Artemis 2 is a go, a 10-day sojourn around the moon that will come within 6,500 miles of the lunar surface. Cook, who watched alongside me as Artemis 1 launched, received the historic assignment in March. Agency officials had tried to surprise her and her NASA crewmates with a clandestine in-person meeting. Two of them ran late, the third dialed in while coming from a doctor's appointment. Mild embarrassment soon gave way to elation. Cook, an electrical engineer and one of the Artemis II mission specialists, has spent her career chasing the allure of the remote, from working at South Pole Research Station to helping build a science instrument that's aboard Juno, a spacecraft now orbiting Jupiter. Three military pilots will be joining her, NASA's Reid Wiseman and Victor Glover, and Canadian Space Agency's Jeremy Hansen. Wiseman, Artemis II's commander, served as NASA's chief astronaut, who chooses crews but can't join them until 2 days before Artemis 1 launched. He regained his flight eligibility just in time. Glover, Artemis II's pilot, was the second in command on NASA's SpaceX Crew 1 mission to the ISS, during which he spent 168 days in orbit. Hansen, Cook's fellow mission specialist, was the first Canadian to supervise the training of a NASA astronaut class. Artemis II will be his first spaceflight. Glover will be the first black astronaut to venture beyond low Earth orbit. Cook and Hansen will be the first woman and non-U.S. citizens, respectively, to do the same. Preparations for the mission are well underway. The SLL core stage for Artemis II is nearly ready for its barge ride to Florida. In a bright room in Kennedy Space Center, technicians in white bunny suits have been testing and resembling the mission's Orion spacecraft, with the Artemis III Orion taking shape nearby. A team led by astronaut Stan Love has been training to serve as Artemis II's capcoms, the main points of contact between the crew and mission control, ready to relay technical directions to detect the quaver in the exhausted astronaut's voice. And by the way, the reference to bunny suits was in quotes, so it's kind of a technical joke, if you will. As soon as November 2024, NASA plans to launch or start launching pieces of small space station called Gateway into orbit around the moon. The space station will act as a staging ground for weeks-long missions to lunar outposts with habitats, power stations, landing pads, and pressurized rovers, all of which are still in the concept stage. This immense infrastructure would be too much for the United States to build alone, so Artemis is teaming up with foreign partners. For more than 22 years, the ISS has orbited 250 miles above our heads with humans on board, thanks to collaboration among the U.S., Russia, Canada, Europe, and Japan. This union has spread the station's cost around and made canceling the program diplomatically difficult. NASA has drawn on those lessons for Artemis. The European Space Agency, ESA, provides Orion service module, which contains the spacecraft's solar arrays and main engine. That cooperation also extends to Gateway, which NASA is building with ESA and the space agencies of Canada and Japan. And NASA is courting private companies to act as moon couriers in hopes of becoming one of the many customers in a lunar economy. A flotilla of privately owned robotic landers will transport science instruments and ice-hunting rover on the moon. At its base in Texas, SpaceX is developing Starship, a reusable rocket even more powerful than SLS. The Artemis III astronauts who land on the moon will leave Earth in an Orion launched by SLS, but then transfer to a version of Starship's upper stage to make their lunar descent. Whether this vision will really yield a sustained human presence on the moon, let alone Mars-bound astronauts, is an open question. Artemis is still in its early days. Starship's first full test flight exploded minutes into launch in April. There's also public support to consider. Since 2019, that's the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing, multiple polls have found that less than a quarter of Americans thought that sending people to the moon should be a top NASA priority. Even during Apollo's days, human spaceflight attracted criticism for spending billions that could address earthbound concerns. Now we're returning to the moon at a time of climate and biodiversity crises, rising political extremism, glaring racial inequalities, and war between Russia and Ukraine. Against this grim backdrop, NASA astronauts are acutely aware that they're not just public figures, but also inspirational symbols of exploration, of science, of the national spirit. Cook has wrestled with how to handle these expectations. For 328 days, she lived and worked aboard the ISS, setting a record for the longest spaceflight by a woman. Her impulse was to downplay the milestone. Then a former colleague reminded her that her achievement might give people a sense of greater possibility. There's nothing inevitable about us venturing beyond the Earth's atmosphere, let alone going to the moon. In microgravity, our blood breaks down, our bones get brittle, our eyesight worsens. Without constant vigilance, we can perish in an instant. Overcoming our biological limits, hundreds of thousands of people have dreamed, planned, and built for decades to make the journey outward not only possible, but routine. If Artemis' vision is realized, that could extend all the way to the moon and maybe even farther. As Cook sees it, these launches are hard-won victories, with setback after setback giving way to one of the purest of human emotions, joy at surpassing our limits. How awesome it is that as a species, as humanity, we are undertaking this right now, that we have decided that it's that important, Cook said. It's because we love exploration. It's because we believe in the power of learning. Quite a story there. Well, our next writer is Christian Davenport, and he's focusing on why the moon exploration is so important, which we touched on briefly in the previous article. Now, his article, The Moon Beckons Once Again, and This Time NASA Wants to Stay, written for the Washington Post originally, then appeared in the January 10, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. And we now have an excerpt from that article. In 2010, during a speech at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, President Barack Obama directed NASA away from its primary target, the moon, to focus its human exploration missions beyond the lunar surface to an asteroid in Mars. I just have to say pretty bluntly here, we've been there before, he said. There's a lot more space to explore and a lot more to learn when we do. The United States has since reversed course, with the moon once again the centerpiece of NASA's exploration goals. Under its Artemis program, born during Donald Trump's tenure and embraced by the Biden administration, NASA has real momentum and bipartisan political support for one of the most ambitious human spaceflight efforts in decades. It began with the launch of the massive SLS moon rocket and the Orion spacecraft on November 16, 2022, a mission without any people on board. The Artemis 1 mission will be followed by subsequent flights with astronauts, first orbiting the moon, then eventually landing on the surface. But despite the progress, the concern raised by Obama still hovers over the space program. We've been there, done that. Why return to the moon? Well, the answer, said Thomas Zurbuchen, the recently retired head of NASA Science Mission Directory, begins with the presence of water. It's important to recognize that we're going back to the moon that's really different than the moon that we left when we took off during Apollo, Zabukin said in an interview. It was a moon that was dry. Our understanding of the moon is massively different. As a result, NASA has made establishing an enduring presence on the moon central to its future space ambitions. It will allow the program to practice how to live in space sustainably. It will allow scientists to tap into the moon's considerable scientific value to learn more about how Earth was formed, and perhaps it would also serve as a stepping stone to Mars and other deep space destinations years into the future. Water is not only key to sustaining human life, but its component parts, hydrogen and oxygen, can be used for a rocket propellant, making the moon a gas station in space. That could be critical for long-duration missions, allowing spacecraft to refuel on the moon instead of lugging all the fuel from Earth. And since the moon's gravity is 1/6 of Earth's, it's a relatively easy springboard to other points of the solar system. The moon also has a story to tell, both about the formation of the solar system and how Earth came to be. Without an atmosphere, it's a time capsule. The Apollo astronauts' footsteps remain intact, undisturbed by weather or wind, as do the scars of billions of years' worth of bombardment of asteroids and comets that were part of the early formation of the solar system. It's less about finding life itself, but it certainly is about the journey to life, Zabukin said. The moon can tell us a lot about our own solar system, the violent processes that created our planets and scarred its surfaces. Part of the Earth history is right there, hanging out over our heads, and it's intimately possible to travel there. Well, getting to the moon is extremely difficult. Living there is even more so, and it's not something NASA has a lot of experience with. The last of the Apollo crews, Apollo 17, spent the most time on the moon, just over 3 days, and that was in 1972. The evolution from the short-term probes to long-term lunar homesteading, from exploration to expansion, will require a serious commitment of resources and new technologies. That's why NASA is looking to build a nuclear reactor on the moon. It's one of several initiatives NASA has begun under its Artemis program, designed to help astronauts stay for extended periods when they'll need power, transportation, and the ability to use the moon's resources. They would also need habitats, rovers, and mining equipment, along with tools to extract the water and mold their lunar regolith, also known as moon dirt, into bricks for habitats. The effort is still very much in its nascent stages, and the funding NASA would need for the long term has not materialized in full. A sustainable presence, despite the rosy predictions coming from the top echelons of the agency, is still years away, and the technical challenges are immense. But NASA has begun developing technologies that would be needed to sustain astronauts on the surface for extended periods. In June of last year, the agency and the Energy Department awarded contracts worth $5 million each to three companies to develop nuclear power systems that could be ready to launch by the end of the decade for a test on the moon. And to jump ahead to a couple of concluding remarks, in terms of what NASA needs to get there, the Artemis 1 mission has a future step, a test flight that NASA said was flawless as the Orion spacecraft flew within 80 miles of the lunar surface, snapping dramatic photos along the way before it returned to Earth. The splash down the Pacific Ocean occurred 50 years ago to the day of the Apollo 17 mission, touching down on the lunar surface, and symbolized the space agency's renewed commitment to the moon. The significance of the Apollo program was transforming the impossible and making it possible, NASA Administrator Bill Nelson said. And now we're going to do that again, but for a different purpose, adds Nelson. This time, we go back to the moon to learn, to live, to work, to invent, to create, in order to get into the cosmos to further explore. So, my friends, I dare say we will be having a lot more discussion about space travel in future episodes of Armchair Traveler. But for today's journey, that's going to do it. And remember, there is part two next week, and we hope that you'll join us for that. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Well, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.